You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio with C.S. Sung. This is Sasha Lilly. It's the second best-selling book of all time after the Bible. I'm speaking about the Communist Manifesto, the classic political document of the revolutionary socialist movement written by Karl Marx and Frederick Engels in 1848. Over 150 years later, the radical polemic and its author's critique of capitalism have seen a remarkable revival. Listeners to the BBC voted Marx history's most revered philosopher, and the New Yorker magazine published a now famous article arguing that the revolutionary consequences of Marx's thought were wrong, but that Marx's economic analysis of capitalism was stunningly accurate. The longer I spend on Wall Street, the more I'm convinced that Marx was right, says an investment banker quoted in that piece. I'm absolutely convinced that Marx's approach is the best way to look at capitalism. Phil Gasper also believes that Marx and the Manifesto are due for a second look. He's edited a new annotated version of the Communist Manifesto, subtitled A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document. Gasper teaches philosophy at Notre Dame de Namur University and is on the editorial board of the International Socialist Review. When I spoke to him recently, I began by asking him to elaborate on why anyone should read the Communist Manifesto today.
Well, one of the interesting things about the manifesto is that even some fairly right-wing commentators are today noticing that its description of the dynamic of capitalist development fits the modern world economy remarkably well. So Thomas Friedman, for instance, the New York Times columnist, wrote a book about globalization last year. Not a very good book, I don't think, but in that he starts by quoting Marx and says that he is in awe of the way that Marx manages to describe the dynamics of globalization. He was writing in the 1840s, but it still seems to fit the modern world economy remarkably well. In fact, perhaps better than it did 50 years ago.
Why did you think there was a need for yet another edition of the manifesto? Because, of course, there have been a number of them, many of them.
Most of them are pretty perfunctory in what they offer you. If you're lucky, a useful introduction and a few notes. And what we tried to do with this edition was make it very, very reader-friendly for people who have no background in certainly Marx's ideas, but maybe no background in politics or economics and so on. Many of my students are like that, but I also think that's true of people who are coming new to political activism as well. So in this edition, you get an introduction, you get a complete annotation of the manifesto with comments on nearly every paragraph. You get a glossary, you get an afterword, you get all the bells and whistles. And the idea was to make it very readable, very approachable for anybody who was new to these ideas.
What was the genesis of this document, which was written by Marx and Engels in 1848 as a revolutionary wave was starting to sweep Europe?
It was commissioned by the Communist League, which was a radical group that Marx and Engels had joined a couple of years before that. Well, let me start a little earlier, because Marx began his political involvement, as you might say, as a radical Democrat. And that's something that continues throughout his whole life of political writing and political activity. He came to the conclusion that radical democracy, real democracy, was not possible without economic democracy, without the common ownership of the means of production. So that brings him to communism. And he and his collaborator Engels realized that they needed some kind of organization, some kind of way of intervening in political life to spread their ideas. And they joined this group, which was originally called the League of the Just. It was mainly German emigre workers living in London and Paris. And their contribution to this group was to say, we've got to give up being conspiratorial, which the League of the Just was. It was a secret organization. We have to proclaim our ideals openly. And we have to have an orientation on building a mass working class movement, which was a very new idea in the 1840s. And they were looking in particular to the Chartist movement in England, which was a huge working class movement fighting for democratic reforms. And Marx's view throughout his life was that movements which begin fighting for reforms within the system have a trajectory which takes them in a more radical direction. So they don't necessarily start off as revolutionary or communist, but they move in that direction. And that's the story which he sets out in the Communist Manifesto. And it was written to proclaim the public existence of the Communist League, and it coincided with the wave of revolutions in 1848 that you talked about.
Well, you just mentioned that Marx gravitated towards communism. I think there's a common perception that Marx and Engels invented communism. I wonder if you could talk about what distinguishes communism and what its history is prior to Marx and Engels coming on the scene.
Sure. Well, it has a long history. I mean, some people say that Plato was the first communist, at least in terms of the rulers of the Republic. Prior to Marx and Engels, communist ideas were basically fairly utopian. People, for centuries had put forward ideas of common ownership and equality and a peaceful society and so on. But in the 1840s, these ideas started connecting with the rise of the modern working class. And I think that Marx's main contribution was to combine those two the ideas of communism with the idea of that this could be achieved by a working class political movement. So that's sort of what made his and Engels' take on this a little bit different. But they didn't claim to be the first communists. And they were certainly influenced by many of those who came before them who put forward ideas which they drew upon.
In the first and most famous section of the manifesto, Marx and Engels lay out a picture of the capitalist world, the emerging capitalist world, that, as many people have said, has a sort of remarkable parallels with our world now and with what has euphemistically been called globalization. I wonder if you could describe for us the brushstrokes in which Marx and Engels paint that world.
Well, they begin, of course, by saying that the history of all society is a history of class struggle. So capitalism, just like all earlier forms of society, ancient slave societies and medieval feudalism and so on, is a class society, despite the fact that writing in the aftermath of the French Revolution, the ideology of the modern capitalist state is equality. But that's not a reality, obviously. So what they do in that first section is, first of all, talk about the rise of the bourgeoisie, how modern capitalists or how modern capitalism emerged. Interestingly, they never used the word capitalism in the manifesto. That was to be introduced by Marx a little later. But they do talk about capitalists, and the capitalists, the people who control the modern economy, are the bourgeoisie. So the first section first begins by talking about the rise of the bourgeoisie, how a group of merchants and manufacturers and so on in the medieval towns and cities was eventually able to overthrow the old feudal order and constitute itself as a new ruling class. And one of the reasons why they go through this historical exegesis is to lay out that capitalism is a relatively new form of society, that it has historical roots, and that it emerged from the contradictions that existed within feudal society. And then that leads them on to the argument that the same kinds of contradictions that characterized feudal society, because it was a class-divided society, are re-emerging under capitalism. And that's the objective basis for thinking that socialism or communism is possible, because capitalism is itself riven with contradictions, in particular the contradictions that exist between the increasingly concentrated and massive forces of production, technology and so on, and individual private property. And they think that those two components can't exist together happily. They lead to economic crises, they lead to huge disruptions. And that is what they think will then lay the basis for a new form of society.
So human history is the history of class struggle, but for Marx and Engels, the emergence of capitalism in some ways breaks with that earlier history. What distinguishes capitalism? What makes it particularly different than earlier modes of production that have preceded it?
Well, it's much more dynamic. Capitalism is based on the market, and the market comes to dominate everything. So everything becomes produced as a commodity. Everything has a price. And the intense competition that exists between individual capitalists or individual capitalist enterprises is what drives the system forward. It's one of the things that they actually admire about capitalism, because they talk about the way in which it has produced technological marvels, the way in which it has increased cosmopolitanism. It rescues people from the isolation that they lived in rural communities and so on. So there are plenty of things which they think advances in terms of what capitalism produces. But at the same time, it's this incredibly competitive, exploitative system. And so many of the great achievements are not available to the majority of the population, or they get them in only tiny, tiny amounts. So there's a huge potential that capitalism brings about, and that makes it different from these earlier societies, which were, though they develop much more slowly. But at the same time, you've got this massive inequality that it produces as well. Inequalities under capitalism are much, much greater than they were in earlier forms of society.
I wanted to ask you, Phil, how Marx and Engels understand the role of the state in capitalist society as portrayed in the manifesto.
Well, the state is the executive, they say, for the whole of the bourgeoisie. They offer a fairly simplistic account of the state. Later on, they offer some somewhat more complex analyses. But the basic analysis, I think, is gets the essential dynamic right, which is that politics is dictated by economics. So the people that have economic power are those that have political power as well. Now, that actually has become a kind of a truism in the modern U.S. when people are constantly talking about the way in which corporate money dominates politics, in which politicians are bought off, and so on. But the difficulty that has been experienced by attempts to limit that shows how deep this problem really goes. It's not just that some politicians are corrupt. It's the whole nature of the political system and the structure of the state that leads it to represent the interests of the wealthiest. So money dominates the electoral process. But even if you get past that and you manage to elect people with radical or progressive views, you then face the difficulty of operating within the framework of a capitalist economy. So take one example. When the socialists were elected in France in the early 1980s, when François Mitterrand became president, mm-hmm. and then they won the parliamentary elections as well, they came in with a fairly radical program. They gave it up almost immediately, not because they'd been bought off, but because investors withdrew their money from France, and there was a crisis of the French currency and so on. And in order to placate the big investors, they had to reverse policy.
Sort of like Lula's Brazil.
Very similar, yeah, to what's happened in Brazil over the past few years. So if you're within a sea of capitalism, and you're trying to operate a political program that is against the interests of the wealthiest and most powerful people, then there are enormous constraints on what you can do. And if you push past those constraints, then the state has the particularly that those parts of the state which are unelected, the military, the bureaucracies which continue to exist, whoever has been elected, they have the power of undermining you in other ways. Everything up to military coups, which we see pretty regularly around the world. So that's what they're talking about when they say that the state is the executive committee for the bourgeoisie. Typically it is, but if it tries not to be, then it will face these huge structural constraints. And that means that there has to be something outside of the official political channels to push forward any sort of radical change. When you see radical change taking place, or even doesn't have to be radical change, but serious political reforms, typically that's they take place because there are huge popular mobilizations, and the political figures realize that without doing something to placate those forces outside of the typical political process, they'll be in trouble. So in order to try and keep things as stable as possible, they then offer concessions. But that's, you know, I think if you look historically in the United States in the 60s or the 30s, periods in which there were very important political reforms, one, the reason is because people managed to mobilize outside of conventional political channels.
Right. As you point out in the book, many people think that Marxism is not viable or relevant because of the disastrous history of the Soviet Union, and some would even trace an authoritarian impulse to the writings of Marx and Engels. Is that fair in your assessment?
Well, I guess neither of those things are fair, I think. I don't think there's an authoritarian impulse in Marx and Engels. Marx was a pretty crotchety figure, and when he got into political debates with people, he could be pretty nasty. But he also could be a very, you know, long-lasting friend to people. And when he makes political arguments, they typically are arguments which are, you know, based on presenting reasons and facts, and they're often very devastating, but they're not. They're not based on, you know, claiming personal authority or character assassination or anything like that. So I don't think that you can trace the development of the Soviet Union in the 20th century or other regimes which claim to be Marxist to some sort of original sin in in Marx's writing or his character. In fact, I think if you want to explain any significant social process or development of a society, you have to look at the kinds of things that Marx was talking about, the material circumstances in which political events develop, that I would say is the tragedy of the Soviet Union, because it was a very popular revolution when it first took place in 1917. It was a revolution that proclaimed itself socialist and had enormous working class support and enormous support from the peasantry, which was, you know, the largest section of the population, but which was extremely isolated. And Lenin and Trotsky and the leaders of the Russian Revolution said, unless we get support from other wealthier, more economically advanced countries, the revolution is doomed. And I think that's the root of the failure of the Russian Revolution, because although there were important revolutions in many countries after World War I, particularly in Germany, you know, the Kaiser was overthrown and so on, they were not successful. They did not go as far as the Russian Revolution. They didn't bring the working class to power. And very quickly, In Russia, the revolution was isolated. The working class was decimated. There's a civil war. There's an enormous disease and death. And you get left a bureaucratic state structure, which is running things now not on behalf of the working class, but on behalf of its own interests. So I think that's really the history of what happened in the Soviet Union, and in many other countries had similar political systems after World War II. You don't even have the initial inspiring beginning. Mm. Instead, you simply have state bureaucracy imposed by Russian tanks.
Well, I think a lot of people might be surprised to know that Marx and Engels wrote about the need for working class self-emancipation, which clearly did not happen in the Soviet Union. Can you talk about that point that they made and how they understood that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a phrase they use quite often, not actually in the manifesto itself, but in some of the prefaces to the manifesto, which they wrote in later years. And it was a phrase that was in the founding statement of the First International, International Working Men's Association that Marx was involved with in the 1860s. The emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class. In other words, you can't look to somebody to do it for you, and you can't act on behalf of others without their active participation. So they saw this as being a mass movement in, you know, literal sense, that people would become active, would play key roles in making decisions. We'd have the most democratic of political movements and of political systems. And I think that was true right at the beginning of the Russian Revolution. The word Soviet is the Russian word for council, and the revolution was based on the power of the councils, the workers' councils that had been set up by the workers in Moscow and Petrograd and many other of the big cities in the Russian Empire. And while that dynamic, vibrant working class democracy existed, the revolution was an inspiration. But as I said, very quickly, those institutions ceased to function because of the economic collapse and the civil war. I think that Marx and Engels would have looked at the later Soviet Union and been appalled by, you know, what was done in their name, because there were some pretty horrific crimes which took place.
Well, there was a model in their lifetimes of a communist revolution, a very short-lived one, the Paris Commune, which took place in 1871, came to power in the city of Paris, and instituted a form of workers' democracy there. Now, clearly, this is after the manifesto was written, long after, but you do use excerpts from their writings about the Paris Commune in this annotated edition. So I just wonder if you could speak about the form that political power took in Paris at that time.
Well, they were very enthusiastic about the Paris Commune, even though Marx realized that it was not going to last, because again, it was one city, and you can't build a socialist alternative in a single city. He wrote a famous pamphlet about it, The Civil War in France, and talks about some of the things that the Commune achieved. For the first time, there was, although not quite universal suffrage, there was every man could vote in the Commune. In fact, one of the weaknesses of the Commune was that women, although they were very active in the Commune, didn't have the right to vote. But there was universal male suffrage. It was introduced. They put all kinds of limits on the people who were elected to the Commune, which was their governing body. They were only to be paid an average workers' wage, so you couldn't get rich through politics. They were to be recallable at any time, so that if they started acting against the wishes of the majority, they would be replaced. They introduced democracy into pretty much every area of the state. So the police were to be appointed by local committees. The courts had the judges elected, and so on. So very, very democratic in its organization. And so for that reason, you know, Marx and Engels are very enthusiastic about it. They purposely had not tried to give any blueprint of what workers' democracy would look like. But when the Commune emerged, they said, this is an example of what we're talking about. This shows that it's possible for ordinary people to play a central role in making political decisions and economic decisions, too. One of the things the Commune did was employers who left Paris in 1871, their businesses were taken over by the workers and run as workers' cooperatives. So all of that they're very enthusiastic about. But it was a very short-lived experiment. 2 months later, the French political establishment regrouped itself, and it sent the troops into Paris and massacred just tens of thousands of people who had participated in the Commune.
Let's spend some time talking about the criticisms that have been leveled against the manifesto. One common position is directed against the manifesto's assertion that the world is increasingly becoming divided between members of the ruling class, that is, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Critics point to the falling number of industrial workers in the advanced capitalist countries as proof of the opposite phenomenon. So is this the case? Is the working class shrinking, and does this disprove the manifesto?
Well, a certain part of the working class is shrinking, certainly in the United States. When Marx and Engels were talking about the working class, they didn't just mean industrial workers or blue-collar workers. That's the section of the working class which has got smaller in the U.S., at least in relative terms over the last 50 years or so. They're talking about anybody who has to work for a wage. In other words, anybody who makes a living simply by selling their ability to work to others. In that very general sense, the working class is bigger than it ever was, because more people find themselves in that situation today, globally, than at any other point in history. In fact, even in Marx's day, the biggest section of the working class in England, which was the most industrially developed country, was not the industrial working class. It was people who were working in domestic employment, servants and so on. And what we've seen in the 150, 160 years since then is that as the economy changes, the structure of the working class is constantly changing. So today there's been a big shift in the U.S. into various forms of service industry. But that covers a wide range of different things. Still, the industrial working class in the U.S. is smaller. Globally, the working class is much bigger. As short as 20 or 30 years ago, the majority of the world's workers were still working in rural areas, were peasants. Today, the majority of the world's workers are, in Marx's sense, working class. They don't own land or have access to land where they are engaged in subsistence farming. There are certainly many people who still are in that situation, but the majority of people are looking for an employer are wage laborers. So, to that extent, that the criticism is false. Now, the real question is, has that change in the structure of the working class affected its ability to organize collectively?
Indeed, right.
And I don't think it has, because even in the U.S., the ability to organize together and to shut down the economy still exists. Whether you are, a bank worker or working in a fast food outlet or a teacher or a nurse. In fact, some of the most militant examples of labor activism in the past 10 or 20 years have come precisely in those sectors. So I think that the dynamic that Marx talks about, the way in which capitalism pushes workers together and gives them an ability to organize collectively, is still there. But it's not an automatic outcome of it requires organization, it requires ideas, it requires initiative. And you can go through long periods in which that's in short supply. And I think that's been true in the United States. Now, I also think it's beginning to change because the duration of the economic crisis in the U.S. Has been such that even though the economy grows, most people's living standard gets worse or certainly doesn't get any better. I think that's beginning to push people in the direction of looking for some form of at least economic organization that can protect them. So where that goes, we still have to see. I think that is still at play.
Eric Hobsbawm, the great Marxist historian, has written of the manifesto that while it describes tremendously well the dynamics of capitalism, its portrayal of the working class as a revolutionary force that will lead the way to a post-capitalist order is dead wrong. And for Hobsbawm, this is because capitalism has found a way of being immensely profitable while still providing workers with a standard of living which is well above the subsistence level. What do you make of this argument?
Well, that too is true. In the most advanced capitalist countries, people's living standards are much higher than they were in Marx's day. But I think it's a mistake to think that Marx's argument depends on the claim that capitalism will drive everybody into pauperism. He uses some of those descriptions in the manifesto. And he may have thought that at the time that he wrote the manifesto. It was easy to think that at the time of the height of the Industrial Revolution, that the vast majority of workers would live in poverty. Now, poverty is still rampant, even in the U.S., but poverty is a relative phenomenon. Today it doesn't mean starving to death in the streets, at least not in the United States. Obviously, in other parts of the world, it still does. But it means being unable to participate in society in the same way that the majority of people are able to do that. So things become necessities in a more advanced society, which weren't necessities in the past. Having a car is a necessity for most people in the United States because we've set up a society in which you can't get to vital functions. You can't get to the supermarket, you can't get to work, you can't drop your kids off at school and so on without having access to that, at least for many, many people. So we raise the sort of level at which you need to be in order to be a functioning member of society, and that relative poverty continues to exist. But I think even beyond that, for people who regard themselves as middle class, for instance, people come to have expectations of what their lives should be like, and when those expectations aren't met, and if they think they're not being met because others are getting far too much, that too can lead them in a radical direction. But I'd also go back to something I said earlier, which is that Marx's view is that the prosperity that leads to relative stability never lasts under capitalism. It's a roller coaster ride, and so you can have periods of considerable prosperity. And then you have periods in which the bottom falls out, and people who thought they were doing relatively well start doing much, much worse. If Marx is wrong about that, if capitalism can provide constant, at least a minimally satisfying life for the majority of the population, then he's wrong about revolution. But if he's right that the economic instability is always there and will undermine little prosperity people have at some point, I think he is right about that, then political radicalism, revolution are things which remain on the agenda.
And that was a conversation I recently had with Phil Gasper about his new annotated edition of the Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, which is subtitled A Roadmap to History's Most Important Political Document. Phil is on the editorial board of the International Socialist Review and is associate editor of Human Nature Review and teaches philosophy. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. With C.S. Sung, I'm Sasha Lilly.